I was reading this. This is an article on Pappy Cannon. Do you guys know who Pappy Cannon is?
Yes.
No, Bob.
He's a major talking head in America since the 80s. He was the co-host on Crossfire. And so they say he pioneered the rhetorical combat that would power the cable news age. So all the yelling and screaming at each other in the debates started in the 80s with him. And he's an interesting figure. He ran for president 3 times. But this article, it says, now he likes Trump. He was pro-Trump. But he's a respectable intellectual right-winger. He worked for Nixon and everybody. So the article says, the ideas made it, but I didn't. The ideas made it, but I didn't. Now, he might be meaning that Trump acts out his ideas. Then it says, underneath, Pat Buchanan won after all, but now he thinks it might be too late for the nation he was trying to save. So you go down to the article, and it says, his first date with his future wife was spent in a New Hampshire motel room drinking wild turkey into the wee hours with Hunter S. Thompson. Do you guys know who Hunter S. Thompson is? You ever heard of him?
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He invented gonzo journalism. So he was covering the Nixon, I guess, campaign in 72 for Rolling Stone, and I didn't know that he was hanging out with Nixon's guy, Nixon's, I don't know, promoter, PR, campaign strategist, whatever he was younger, but I guess Thompson had to talk to these guys as doing part of the article. So Thompson's, Buchanan's first date with his future wife was with Hunter S. Thompson, so that's quite a notch in your resume. He stood, and then says, he stood several feet away from Martin Luther King Jr. during the I Have a Dream speech. That'd be about 1963. He went to China with Richard M. Nixon and walked away from Watergate unscathed. He survived Iran-Contra, too, and sat alongside Ronald Reagan at the Reykjavik summit, that's in Iceland, 1985, November 85, where Reagan, I think at that one, said, we've got to worry about UFOs invading. The famous statement he said, we'd all get together and not have our local wars if we were invaded by life from outer space. Then it says, Pat Buchanan invaded America's living rooms. Now look at the media realities of all this. Okay, he was with an author. He was with Martin Luther King doing a famous TV speech. He went to Nixon with Nixon's PR stuff, opening up China, which we know from mine was because we were so indebted to China, we went to him. Nixon went to China with hat in hand, begging for something. So China said, okay, we'll help you financially, but you give us Walmart. We're going to put this store in there that will sell all our stuff we make here in China. He survived Iran-Contra. That's another big TV hearing. He sat alongside Ronald Reagan at a PR opportunity, a summit meeting, the beginning of the end of the Cold War. Then he invades America's living rooms and pioneered the rhetorical combat that would power the cable news age. He defied the establishment by challenging a sitting president of his own party. He challenged Bush, number one. He captured the fear and frustration of the right by proclaiming a great culture war was at hand. Another media dynamic, culture war, culture iconography. And his third party candidacy in 2000 almost certainly handed George W. Bush the presidency, thanks to thousands of Palm Beach, Florida residents mistakenly voting for Buchanan on the butterfly ballot, that's in quotes, when they meant to back Al Gore. So because he ran as a third party and people voted for him accidentally and they thought they were voting for Gore, that's why Bush, too, became president. Okay? He's like a Forrest Gump. He's everywhere. Oh, this says that in the next sentence. If not for his outsized ambition, Pat Buchanan might be the closest thing the American right has to a real-life Forrest Gump, that patriot from ordinary stock whose life journey positioned him to witness, influence, and narrate the pivotal moments that shaped our modern world and changed the course of this country's history. And that's all the parallel track of TV history, right? This is more the TV landscape. He has known myriad roles, neighborhood brawler, college expellee, I guess he got expelled from college, journalist, White House advisor, political commentator, presidential candidate 3 times over, author and provocateur. and his existence traces the arc of what feels to some Americans like a nation's ascent and decline. He was 3 years old when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and 6 when Harry Truman dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now 78, with thick black glasses and a thinning face, Buchanan looks back with nostalgia at a life and career that, for all its significance, was at risk of being forgotten until Donald Trump was elected 45th President of the United States. So in the year or two before Trump was elected, nobody was paying any attention to Pat Buchanan. But he's now seen as the source of ideas that Trump uses. So it says, and that's a quarter of a century, 25 years before. A quarter century before Trump descended into the atrium of his Manhattan skyscraper to launch his unlikely bid for the White House, Buchanan, until then a columnist, political operative, and TV commentator, stepped onto a stage in Concord, New Hampshire, to declare his own candidacy 10 weeks ahead of the state's presidential primary. Associating the globalist President George Bush I with, quote, bureaucrats in Brussels pursuing a European superstate that trampled on national identity, Buchanan warned his rowdy audience, quote, we must not trade in our sovereignty for a cushioned seat at the head table of anybody's new world order, unquote. His radically different prescription, which would underpin 3 consecutive runs for the presidency. Here's what they are. 1, a new nationalism that would focus on forgotten Americans left behind by bad trade deals, open border immigration policies, and foreign adventurism. That means no wars in the rest of the world. His voice booming, Buchanan demanded, quote, should the United States be required to carry indefinitely the full burden of defending rich and prosperous allies who take America's generosity for granted as they invade our markets? This is this rhetoric, deployed again during his losing bid for the 1996 GOP nomination, and once more when he ran on the Reform Party ticket in 2000, not only provided a template for Trump's campaign, but laid the foundation for its eventual success. Dismissed as a fringe character for rejecting Republican orthodoxy on trade and immigration and interventionism, Buchanan effectively weakened the party's defenses, allowing a more forceful messenger with better thinking to finish the insurrection he started back in 91. So Trump is a more forceful messenger with better timing. All the ideas that seemed original to Trump's campaign could in fact be attributed to Buchanan. From depicting the political class as bumbling stooges to singling out a rising superpower as an economic menace, now that was back then Japan, not China, to rallying the citizenry to take back a country whose destiny they no longer dictated. Pitchfork Pat, as he was nicknamed, even deployed a phrase that combined Trump's 2 signature slogans, quote, make America first again. So what do you think of that? You guys knew that? Did you know that Buchanan was homeopathically replayed by Trump?
No. Yeah. It's like Trump is using Buchanan in the way that you use McLuhan.
Right.
So he's saying things, but he's actually quoting somebody else in a way.
But see, this is the newspaper's version of Trump. They're going to lay out visually defined, literate points. They think Trump was a bunch of themes or ideas. We know Trump was quadriphenic. Okay. So the McLuhan or the Bob McLuhan way is to say this is the newspaper speaking. Media are the actors. This is the newspaper looking for its philology, its etymology. In its terms, we must find the literate antecedent. We must find the source of the ideas. And they find Buchanan. All right? So this is a biased. It's limited about the whole full range of what Trump is. Remember, he's a TV star. He's a billionaire. He's in many other worlds, not just in the newspaper world. I'm going to post this on the McLuhan thing. Okay, so here's the McLuhan talking about pregnancy. Oh, here's Bert. Bert's review's in. Bert, like, he's the first to get to the newspaper office and type up a review. His headline says, Super Black Caucus Orientation, Bob. He's liking the Black Caucus emphasis today. Now, there's a biased guy. He thinks he's black. You know, he's identifying with the blackness of himself. Meanwhile, Michael says, Bob, stop speaking English. We can't understand you. But I'm referring to – my English I'm using many media archetypes in what I'm referring to. That's what people talk about. They'll cite, they want to explain something, they'll cite a sports star, and then maybe a comedian, and then some song, and then Trump. You know, that's the way. Look at how language is made up of images from different cliche environments.
Mm.
Right? And Finnegan's Wake was attempting to do that way back 80 years ago. So I posted that. Now I'll post the Pat Buchanan article because it is a good inventory. I like reading articles like this because it reminds me of all the different history points. Like, look at what they've run through his life, all these events that I haven't thought about in 2 days. And then I think about him again. And I used to like those kind of articles because I could, when I was on CKLN, I had the historical marker points at the tip of my tongue, you know, because I would note them, remember them, memorize them, or do it. So then people thought, holy shit, Bob knows a lot. And I'm just quoting media landscapes. And also, this article is on April 22nd. Is his date. That is a very important date in Club 22, and we played Bill Turk posted some commercial for Club 22. And Greece, Athens. Yes, and 2-2 is a number that's aware of the effects of the alphabet. Number 7 is not aware of the alphabet. The LaRouche quadrant is number 7. That's where 7 is the lucky number. That superstition, but in the McLuhan quadrant, it's 2-2. It's understanding the metaphor of media. So we're being aware of the phonetic alphabet. That's what we started talking about. Okay, and so they have a picture of Pat Buchanan here. What's he doing? He's reading the New York Times. See, there's the newspaper celebrating this guy using their medium.
Yep.
Get this. This is a new way to understand media imagery. We're in a museum now where Bob's, you know, an art critic walking through the media environment via my screen describing the hits and misses of the cognitive school versus the moral school in art history. So it says here a guy named Greg Mueller, who served as Buchanan's communications director on the 1992 and 96 campaigns and remains a close friend, he says, Pat was the pioneer of the vision that Trump ran on and won on. But the point is that Pat was not – they say you have to have good timing. No, there has to be a proper figure ground of media dynamics. He couldn't have run one back then. The Global Village was – Global Membrane was just being noticed through the Internet. So nobody's going to rebel against it yet, and nobody has the means to rebel against it. You don't have – you have Web 2.0. So you see – journalism is always shoddy. It just talks about the super flashy figures. No ground. Of course, they're not allowed to talk about the ground, but that's what we're doing here. We're explaining the ground of this easy journalistic style of writing. You get me?
Yep.
Yeah.
So Michael Kinsley was the first opponent on CNN's Crossfire in the 80s. He was the liberal guy. And so they quote him. They just right after this Greg Mueller talks about the vision of Trump from Pat, Michael Kinsley, the liberal former New Republic editor who co-hosted CNN's Crossfire with Buchanan, likewise credits his old sparring partner with laying the intellectual groundwork for Trumpism. Quote, it's unclear where this Trump thing goes, but Pat deserves some of the credit. He pauses, or some of the blame, because, you know, Kinsley's a liberal. Now, they'd have no clue what I'm talking about, and my stuff is always the most accurate. Oh, Trump is a shaman, and he's hijacked the White House to do shamanic communication. They're not thinking on that level at all. And it's not eccentric. Mm-hmm. Once you know the figure ground of media, you come up with my statement. It's a law. It's objective art. Once you're an expert on to analyzing this stuff this way, you then automatically come up with that thing I came up with about Trump. So then they go, go ahead.
No, I was going to say cognitive versus moral.
What about it?
That's what you came up with Trump, that he was
Cognitive style. Yeah, the cognitive. Yeah, yeah. And journalism is the ethical world, the world of ethics. You know, TV doesn't have as much ethic. They can't even fucking stay on one point. They got to have another image and another show and another content and more. It just goes, flows on like a river, the first word of fitting its wake. But newspapers have time to think and talk and reflect and write it out. It's a slower world. That's the world of ethics and morals. So so they say Buchanan, for his part, feels both validated and vindicated. Long ago, okay, so he doesn't understand what's going on either, right? He's identifying with the content part of Trump. Long ago resigned to the reality that his policy views made him a pariah in the Republican Party and stained him irrevocably with the ensuing accusations of racism, anti-Semitism, and xenophobia. So I remember in New York, we got there in 93, there were magazines. The election was over, but I found some magazines that weren't in Toronto, some old lefty magazines in 92, and they had cover articles on Buchanan and had Hitler stuff over him. He was considered far-right Nazi thinking, like they tried to put on Trump. But way back then, he was considered... so they were thinking, okay, this guy will bring in Nazis. We're all end up in concentration camps. Chemical body worries. No, the Nazism is on a whole other level. It's dealing with the effects of tweeting versus the media. You know, it's not Nazism. It's some kind of Rumpelstiltskin stuff going on. So the imagery in journalism is always rearview mirror. Let's see. So he has lived to see. So he was a pariah, accused of racism, xenophobia. He has lived to see the Republican Party come around to Buchananism and the country send its direct descendant to the White House. So then he says, I was elated, delighted that Trump picked up on the exact issues on which I challenged Bush. And then he goes and uses my slogan. It just doesn't get any better than this. Buchanan, who has published such books. So he's hypnotized by his own baby, who's going to shock the hell out of him as Trumpism becomes what nothing like what they think he is. Buchanan, who has published such books as, quote, The Death of the West. That's a replay of Otto Spengler's book, The Decline of the West, in the 20s that Wyndham Lewis made fun of and McLuhan used to talk about. The Death of the West, State of Emergency, Day of Reckoning, Suicide of a Superpower. So they name all these books. They say Buchanan admits that November's elections result gave me hope for the first time in recent memory. Now, we got to see what he's saying now, because he's saying the country can't be saved. He's probably going to go into how, well, Trump didn't actually do very good the first 100 days, and they were fucked up. I don't know, but he thought it was significant that Trump won. Yeah, because then the next line says, but none of this means he's suddenly bullish about America's future. Buchanan says he has always been a pessimist, and despite Trump's conquest, two things continue to color his dark forecast for the nation. First, Buchanan harbors deep concerns over whether Trump, with his off-topic tweeting and pointless fight-picking, has the requisite focus and discipline to execute his nationalist agenda. See? Fucking Buchanan has no clue what Trump is. He thinks it's the newspaper. This is the newspaper worried about whether Trump is a newspaper. He's worried, Buchanan, especially over the opposition of a media establishment complex bent on Trump's destruction. Second, even if Trump delivers on the loftiest of his promises, Buchanan fears it will be too little, too late. That's what Dave Wirtz used to say to me. Too little, too late. Sweeping change was needed 25 years ago, he says, before thousands of factories vanished due to the North American Free Trade Agreement, before millions of illegal immigrants entered the country, before trillions of dollars were squandered on regime change and nation building. That's the war stuff. He's not unlike the countless Trump voters I met across the country in 2016, many of them older folks yearning for a return to the country of their youth, a place they remember as safer, whiter, more wholesome, more Christian, more confident, and less polarized. The difference is that Buchanan refuses to indulge in the illusion that a return to this utopia of yesteryear is even possible. economically and demographically and culturally, he believes the damage is done. We roll the dice with the future of this country, he tells me, and I think it's going to come up snake eyes. So then they go through his past, his history. Let's see if we get some more statements. They say, such assured, okay. Buchanan has had plenty of titles over the years, from spokesman to candidate, but his favorite is historian. He cherishes history. See, there's visual space. He cherishes history, not just for its drama, but for the lessons bequeathed and the parallels he can extract. The seductive appeal of populism, the rising tide of nationalism, the similarities between the current president and the two he worked closely alongside, that's Reagan and Nixon. Above all, Buchanan loves history because in his mind it contains our civilizational apex. Civilization is visual space. He treasures the past because he is convinced that his beloved country, these United States, will never again approach the particular kind of glory it held for a middle-class family in the post-war years. Such assured pessimism is somewhat surprising, given that Buchanan's boldest achievement, and perhaps the most lasting aspect of his legacy, was being Trump before Trump was Trump. So he says, the ideas made it, so this is what he means, the Trump replaying his ideas. The ideas made it, Buchanan tells me, letting out a belly laugh, but I didn't. So, now it says, there is some sad irony in the fact that Buchanan, whose vision is finally penetrating and driving the uppermost echelons of government, has seen his public profile diminish to an all-time low. This is somewhat intentional. Since being fired from MSNBC in 2012, he's hunkered down, content to make occasional Fox News appearances, write two columns a week for Creator Syndicate, and spend more time at home with his wife, Shelley, binge-watching television shows such as 24 and Homeland. Those are two of my favorite shows. And then Claire Danes is the nutty CIA officer in Homeland. So he says, I dated a girl who reminded me of Claire Danes. That's the actress. She was crazy as a hoot owl. Buchanan grins. Then it says, the couple doesn't get out too often. They attend 9 a.m. Sunday Mass at St. Mary Mother of God Church near Capitol Hill, then shop at their local Safeway and settle in for the coming week. They have an occasional dinner out at Jay Gilbert's Steakhouse in McLean, Virginia, but mostly have simple meals at home. When it's not Lent, Buchanan has two glasses of Gurgitch Hills Chardonnay each night. The slower pace suits a man who has battled heart problems and had several hospital stays in recent years. Okay. His intellectual metabolism, however, remains turbocharged. After he walks a half mile each morning around his neighborhood, Buchanan and his wife, who was Nixon's former secretary, whom he calls Junior and Kiddo, despite the fact that she's slightly older than he is. So his wife, they walk around, do a morning walk, brew 8 cups of coffee in a pot that is often finished by noon. In those intervening hours, Buchanan, hopped up on coffee, that's what I'm adding, Buchanan reads and annotates copious amounts of news. He just reads. He begins with Drudge Report and Antiwar.com, two aggregators of reporting and opinion, one from the right and one from the libertarian-leaning left. Before weaving his way, red markup pen at the ready through the print editions of his 5 preferred newspapers, the New York Times, Washington Post, Washington Times, Wall Street Journal, and Financial Times. He used to read USA Today, too, but recently canceled the subscription. This daily intake informs Buchanan's well-considered stances on every current event we discussed during our conversation and provides fodder for his columns, which, however distasteful they may be to many on the left and some on the right, cannot possibly be mistaken for material poorly researched. So you see, they're making the print man as the archetype of Trump. You know, Trump doesn't fucking know how to read. I don't think it's Trump. Now, here's what's funny. There's some Dave Emery, I was listening to him a few months ago, and he was given the Nazi background of Trump. And he quotes Trump. There's a great biography of this of Trump where it really muckrakes him. And he goes to Aspen, Colorado, to one of these New Age think tanks symposium. So all these New Age people are telling these businessmen how to be a nice guy and be a Christian or whatever they tell them, how to regain their power and all this stuff. And Trump comes on and tells him what a bastard he was in business and quotes the Bible. And he quotes the Bible totally fucking wrong. He gets the quote wrong. He has the wrong meaning, and he's celebrating the Bible supports me being a total asshole and never trust your guy, never give him an even break. This is how he performs at this new age, softy place. He remembers, what is it? Reagan, when in his presence, now here's where Trump has a conglomeration of everybody. Reagan, they used to make fun of him as Bongo, the monkey, right? He was in movies with this monkey, and he would perform in war movies and after the war. And then he would talk about his great record of achievement in the war, and he thought he'd fucking fought in the war. He'd forgotten that he'd only been in movies about the war. This was the first virtual president, right? This is the beginning of the end of truth, where whatever media you were in was real. And they made fun of Reagan being a total retard who forgot that he actually didn't fight in World War II. So that's a part of Trump, right? Trump comes along and he quotes the Bible and he quotes it all wrong and he has the wrong meaning and he says, nobody knows the Bible as well as I do. He can't even quote one sentence right. And this guy, he's living in another way. He's much like me, I must admit. He's much like me. He exaggerates everything beyond, like, I'm the most important person who ever lived in history. That's the kind of stuff I say. Well, he comes close to it, right? You know, the megalomania of Web 2.0, where everybody is a super god because they got their own media broadcasting station, you must have a huge fucking ego. You must have narcissism to survive in this new media. And I, of course, take it further than anybody. That's why LaRouche, Ion says that Trump is doing me. I set the standard. I don't see you guys typing, I am the greatest fucking person who's ever lived in the history of humanity. You don't dare type that on your Facebook page. You don't even have a Facebook page. You're back in the 90s, you guys. Sorry, I'm turning on you. You better start speaking, or I'll fucking really get mad. So say something.
Fucking mad.
Oh, sorry. I've got a lot of you muted. I guess you fell off and came back on. Okay, sorry. I take that back. All right, speak.
Thanks, Bob.
I almost shot you guys. Lucky the gun wasn't loaded.
We're
trying to speak.
Okay, speak. One at a time. What, Sean? What are you saying?
We proclaim it every day.
You what? We time it.
We proclaim it that Bob's. Yeah, what we don't type, it's because we're proclaiming it and we're living
That's
it.
That's right. Yeah, you're too busy promoting me. You know, why
yeah.
go on and imitate me? Just promote the original guy. I agree with that. Yeah. Yeah, and Michael, your opinion, your contribution is?
What I was going to say, Bob, it's Nicholas. Morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Buchanan was working on a medium that's been obsolesced, so he reads his 5 newspapers daily in a medium that's gone.
Right, and he's stuck there. Now, that's his fundamentalism. That's his mythic stage, the media he is obsessed with and can't leave. That's his real makeup. So he writes about being aware of this or being that or anybody back of that generation who writes about techniques of awareness like a guru. They're totally unaware of what they fucking actually are. They haven't incorporated the McLuhan dynamic as awareness techniques. Like he has no clue.
And the rest of the world is also fixated in that same space.
Well, no, many aren't in that space. They're in different media spaces. That's what my chart shows.
Yeah,
some are in the
TV
space. Some are in music, some are in computers, some are in satellite, following NASA or looking out there at space, whatever the Hubble telescope's showing. But usually people are hopping from one to the other now. They're quadraphenic. And none of those media spaces, their analog media, have any reality today. And that's why we're reading critical semiotics with this crazy talk that's beyond meaning to point to the beyond meaning Quadrophenia. Like, I don't think Gary knows about my Quadrophenia talk or anything that I say. He might have heard it once or something, hasn't paid any attention. And he's going to probably be irked at how I'm taking his stuff and using it to prop up my case, which is his case, but presented in a bit simpler, knowable terms. I'm not getting all wordy. Yeah. I'm not writing a book about it. I'm just stating it with the up-to-date medium of voice generation. Mm. You know, why write a book? So now we have, so Trump is quadriphenic. So he at one point is TV, and at another point he's chip body, twittering, and he is conducting a war among the media archetypes within himself. He gets on the TV and does his presidential sane talk, inaugural speech that's measured and balanced, and then he becomes a Twitter guy and cancels that out by being a fucking child, supposedly, you know, attacking the TV body, CNN. And then what's he do? What's the other thing? Then he gets chemical
and
body,
and
he goes to rallies.
He also attacks the newspapers on Twitter.
Well, he attacks all the older media, but the newspaper is part of the TV landscape. They're all inside the TV iconography. But yes, there is a literate part. The book values, and Trump supports the book values, the archetypal, we need to get Americans back with their integrity and their individual initiative and all that the great individual can do, the great American. You know, that's book values. Then how is he a satellite guy? He invades elections all over the world. He advises the Brexit people to vote Brexit. You know, he influences the world. Now that's part of the TV landscape. I guess maybe the bombing is his satellite self. He's begun his satellite self by bombing whoever he bombed last week with the big bomb. That would be satellite surveillance stuff, right? That would be more of a, on a simple level, the satellite idea. So he's juggling all these things, as all presidents did before, you know, starting with maybe Reagan. So the 80s is really full-blown Dobbstown quadrant, Coker and Dobbstown, 80s, multimedia, virtual reality. So, but Trump is going past the juggling of the four media or the four zones. He's actually showing that he does not juggle professionally. He juggles. He drops the balls all the fucking time. He doesn't even try to juggle properly. Mm. He is a scattershot. Anarchy. And that may be the new way to be president. Just be an uncontrollable, unpredictable force.
A disruptor.
Like everybody else is in Facebook land.
Mm.
That's what the average citizen is. Who was this saying it? Somebody was outraged at something. Yeah, they didn't like, there was some sane article about how stupid Trump is. And this person was shocked at the comments. Said, look at the comments. What the hell's going on? Because every comment was an alt-right fucking goon just coming in and swearing their heads off and making fun of the so-called reasonable person who presented something. And this Canadian was quite shocked at the violence of it. They don't recognize that's what's going on every forum.
Really level.
Yeah, see, we are too, sitting here explaining things is way too boring for Web 2.0 people.
Mm.
Or too introspective, too slow.
Bob, what
but when, Ian, well, when Ian's here, we're not. No, I take that back. If Ian's here, then we're fucking up to date, right? We got our fucking alt-right guy in here, alt Astrobody.
He's disappeared.
So what are we
now?
Gonna, yeah, he's taking a break. So, or doing something real serious, or this is such a serious time, he's got to lay low because of what the shit's going on. You know, take your pick.
I was listening to McLuhan, Bob, and you were talking about the hockey game, and it was interesting for McLuhan turned and said, without an audience, there would be no game. And he was referring to the violence in these games, which is really, really interesting. So, you know, Trump's got his audience, and without that audience, you know, who constantly rant and rave about, you know, what Trump's doing or what he's not doing, take away the audience, and Trump would really be insignificant, like the hockey game or any other type of game would be obsolete.
Okay, now this is where there are many McLuhan statements float around what you're saying. You know, it's very appropriate what you're saying. First one, way back in the 70s, there are no more passengers on Spaceship Earth, only crew. That means the whole global audience is involved in creating wealth, which is just noise, right? So then he said way back there in the 60s that sport is war under wraps. So it is
organized
war.
Yes. Organized violence.
Yeah, organized violence. And let's see, he wrote one of his last articles before a stroke in late 79. It came out the first month of 1980, so it was a prediction for the 80s in Canada's Time magazine called McLean's Magazine. He ends the article by saying that the audience will get more and more involved in the sport, the sporting world. He already had said 20 years before that to have a game without an audience is just a practice, a rehearsal. You've got to have an audience.
That's right.
But then he said, 20 years later, the audience is going to dominate the game and totally fuck with it. And so throughout the 80s, what became the big imagery out of Europe were the fucking boneheads, whatever they call skinheads, fucking attacking people at the rugby games. Remember that? That's audience getting involved. They would have fights around the stadium, you know, gang
the soccer
fights.
Hooligans.
Yeah, soccer hooligans. That was the new image of sport. Was the artist getting the act, and they said, fuck this sport, let's just have war. Basically a war all week long. So there was something that he predicted, and it always went a bit further than he predicted. It was more extreme. Like he predicted in 67, there's going to be a lot of new bizarre forms, bizarre events, like Twiggy. Do you guys remember Twiggy? The little skinny girl, London fashion.
Yeah. Model.
And that was considered a bizarre form. You know, within 6 months, there was incredible bizarre forms in 68. There was Zappa, there was Jefferson Airplane, there was LSD, there was the late 60s, all those imagery, you know, that you have, riots, assassination, 68. So McLuhan, he had the best, most accurate statement. There was going to be nothing but more and more bizarre forms, but nobody was ready for how fucking bizarre it was going to be. But he had to be, that's why he's relevant. He had the closest to what was coming. He even knew it would be further than him, but I don't know. He didn't have the words. The event hadn't happened, so he just said, Twiggy, we're going to have a lot more bizarre forms coming. He predicted in 1975, 76 that Reagan will be the perfect president because he's a person who merges his self with the role. In other words, he's an actor. He predicted that. And, you know, people go back and read McLuhan, or they hear a bit about McLuhan, and they say, well, that's pretty good. Today it's way worse. They don't understand that back then he was really exaggerating what was happening. People thought, and that was the closest to what was coming, but people get stunned by what's happening today, and McLuhan stuff seems too bland, too simple. But people don't realize how simple it was in the 60s in the media diet compared to now. I mean, there's no way in 1970, I imagined that I'd fucking have access to a fucking microphone and be able to sing with my tone-deaf wife into other people and then play fucking replays of myself from 2 years. The whole media thing's fucking impossible, which shows you how unaware. I mean, I'm a pretty aware guy, but I had no clue what was coming. You know, nobody did. That's why we got to – you need Ion to fucking up the ante. He starts telling you really extreme stuff for what you got to get ready for. Yeah. And, you know, and if you don't do this, don't know about it, you don't think you need it, you're clueless. And therefore, we're shocked to you. But, there's no way. I mean, back then in the 60s, you had to have fucking some kind of talent to even get on the media. You know what I mean? Nowadays, you have children refusing to go to school so that they can have their own talk show. That's, what's her name? Sarah's son. Noah. What are they talking about? They're talking about the technology they work with, the cartoon bullshit apps, whatever they make their stuff out of, right? They talk about their own little technology world that the parents know nothing about.
Oh, it's interesting. It's interesting that you mentioned that. I had to meet up with the principal at my daughter's school, and we were having a conversation at meet the parent, meet the teacher, or whatever, you know, one of those horrible things.
Yeah.
And I said to him, would you consider that, first of all, I asked him if he'd read McLuhan, and he said, who? He said, no, he's never heard of him. This is the senior educator at my daughter's school. And then
how
I asked him,
How old is he? Give us a little more data.
He's probably about 60? 40, 45, 50, somewhere around there.
Jesus Christ, half our age, Carol. And he's a senior guy. And,
he's a senior
45,
guy.
50. So he would be born... In 70s, yeah,
63.
He born after
70s.
He wouldn't be conscious till the 63. Okay, so he wouldn't be conscious till 70. So yeah, he wouldn't know anything about McLuhan or that world even.
But Bob, I
so
said
you
to him,
say this to him. What happened next?
No, but then I said to him, I said, would you consider that your job has been obsolete with technology? So he looked at me and he said, well, what would we do with the school? I said, well, maybe you'd turn it into a fun playground or something like that, because the kids are already teaching themselves. So he wasn't particularly amused with me.
That's right. You're going to be investigated, arrested probably, if you keep this up.
Terrorism.
I had a couple of the other...
Yeah, go ahead. So what did
I had a couple
he,
of the
he...
other...
Yeah, but when you did this, were you by? Were you with him alone?
No, there were about four or five teachers of his teachers that were around. And I said, well, you know, possibly you're going to be obsolete, which is probably in the next five or I don't know how many years. And then what are you going to do? And he said, we'll never, it'll never, ever happen. I said, it's already happened. And then I laughed. I kind of used a Bob thing, you know, like make it all into humor. And he like looked at me with a very stern face.
Yeah, you were threatening him. And there were other teachers around listening to you?
Yeah, they were all sitting there listening. I said, has anybody read McLuhan? Because I think it's really critical.
Has anybody here read Bob Dobbs? You guys have not read Bob Dobbs?
You know what my acid test is for the RNA, Bob? My first question is, what do you think of Trump? And then they start ranting and raving. I said, the RNA is not for you, nor is Bob.
That's right. But the amazing thing is that, it is a slower world there, but maybe not so much now, right? You sort of got a bit of the media dynamic, but your institutions are probably a bit slow.
Well, they're bringing all this technology into the schools now, Bob, where they've got all these, you know, these... laptops and various iPads and things like that. So, you know, what does the teacher become? It obsolesces the teacher completely, because now all of the information is force-fed. They read through the curriculum. So what does the teacher actually do in the classroom?
Right.
And as my daughter said to me, she said, Dad, none of these people teach us anymore. They give us the work, we read it, we learn it, and then we spit it out again and do it again the next day. So why do I need to go to school? Thankfully, she's in her last year of school. So, yeah, anyway.
Right. Well, what do they do? Like, the teacher doesn't lay out stuff on the blackboard. They tell them what to read on the internet. And then they read it. That's homework. People, when they wish to go to school, they do that at home, you know, read or something. But they have to do it at school.
Yeah. Well, there's not much teaching going on at the moment, Bob. From the feedback that I received the other night.
Interesting.
Really interesting. Mm.
And you're up against... See, back in McLuhan's day, people thought they were interested in new ideas. Naively coming out of the 50s, early 60s, they hadn't heard every idea. They thought they were going somewhere. Oh, you got new ideas? Sure, let's do it. They didn't know that they would be assassinated, fucking imprisoned, bombed by MKUltra programs by the end of the 60s for even entertaining new ideas. So then everybody went into retreat and stopped really in institutions taking in new ideas. Other than in society, everybody started doing cults or private seminars like the Werner Erhard S seminar. So everybody went... So the learning thing happened in your private life, but not in mainstream society. That had been disappeared or taken over by the Nazis. So was my point there. Is so McLuhan rose on a naivety about, yeah, we need new ideas. Now you're looking at people who do not want ideas, and they don't want anything. They want everything to be ignored so they can carry on doing their nothingness.
Yeah.
Just keep the rule. Let me keep doing this teaching, even though it has no practical meaning to anything other than I'm a babysitter for your kids.
But you know what is interesting, Bob? I was listening to the archive where you and Ian were chatting about Anastasia. There was a whole thing going on, and there was the school that was started up in Russia, and it was really, really interesting to hear you and Ian talking about how that schooling environment, where there's a sort of a collective, where kids are teaching each other and they bring in a relevant expert, and then they continue their learning through almost a self-learning. Mm. And I was really, really intrigued to stumble on that, because that whole Anastasia range of books.
Was that the tree woman? Is that the Anastasia that lived out in
Siberia?
Yeah. The guru. And the people
whole...
who wrote the books. Do you remember this statement?
Yeah.
Ian said that people who wrote the books knew nothing of her, and they were creating a media phenomenon, a book phenomenon, that this girl, this Anastasia, would have nothing to do with. You remember that part?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah,
I listened to that archive.
Con.
It was really interesting. Yeah, it was a ploy to get the book sold.
Yeah. And they actually, I forgot that. They had schools. She had some kind of vision for a self-generating school.
School, that's right. It was an open sort of source school where everybody, the kids, in a sense, taught themselves. They were given a task, and they had to go and research the task, and then they had to teach it back to the kids. And it was really interesting to hear what Ian had to say about that whole schooling environment and how it was an interplay, and how, it, in a sense, I don't know when the book was written, about 10 years ago, how it obsolesced teaching if it did have to go in that direction. And I think that's where the McLuhan comes in. There is no audience any longer. So, you know, what does the teacher do in the classroom? What is the teacher's role?
She has to help them make. They must make pattern recognition. But what's stupid is that they say, you got to read this and that, and then spew it back. That's still old-fashioned retaining knowledge, as if you have to have a memory. None of these kids are going to think that's useful. They got to be on their toes to make up shit every day, as their friends make up shit, you know, because everybody's a creator now.
Yeah.
And, so the teachers – and so you'll hear way back then, I would be saying on with Ion that the PTA, the Teachers Association, the actual – teachers who think, you know, you can get a lot of mileage with, we need more money put into education, the teachers should be valued, you know, all this bullshit about replenishing the educational world, where that archetype is the biggest fascist archetype, if you think of fascism as some kind of holding back some irrelevant old situation that's really harmful. That's what teaching is. The teachers are the biggest, they're the fascists, because they keep the book bullshit going. And they need the jobs. Education is the biggest con. And these kids are getting educated for the present beyond anything the teachers are going to do. And they will probably, you could say that they can be competent. The kids will be competent, but they just won't know some things, and they'll just make mistakes. And they should have someone like my kind of talk presented to them about their environment and bullshitting about the patterns of that. That's what they live in. And that's what should be talked about, not anything about any previous topic. I mean, they don't even do math or whatever they do in labs. It's all like you don't have to learn mathematics. You have to learn how they run their apps in the mathematical laboratories, right? I mean, they don't do it the way they used to teach it. They don't do anything in those labs that's not computer-based, and anybody could go in there and learn how to do it, work in be a technician in the lab. Nobody's really go ahead.
Quite interesting to see how when you come up with something like McLuhan or that your job's going to be obsolesced, how threatening those words just in a sentence can seem to somebody who's really trying to guard themselves against losing a job. You know,
and that's everybody.
And they see themselves important in the society, which really at the end of the day, behind their backs, ridicules them because they...
Yeah.
what are they learning? They're not. You don't need maths, as you rightly say, in this new environment.
And that's partly, it's the little man, this is the final stage of democracy, is the little man rules. And Ayn said the little man's going to get his ass whooped real bad, if not already. Because they're the establishment. People think, you know, Rockefeller's the establishment. No, Rockefellers can't do anything because they got surrounded by little men who believe in visual space and want to have a visual identity.
Mm.
So the little man's going to get nailed violently by Trumpism and what Trump's a front for.
Yeah, I think Bert summed it up on the chat line. He said, great background read on Pat Buchanan. Bob, exclamation mark. I don't know what I am, comma, Bob.
I don't know what I am. You're an Ionaut, Bert. Be proud of it. You're a black Ionaut. You're black caucus. Stick with that, Bert. Serve you well. Everybody's turning black anyways. Nicholas, Bob, please unmute you. Well, that's a while ago, eh? Unmute you?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Nicholas.
No, I was muted for a while.
Okay, so let's just check the end. I want to see how that article ends. Let's see, where did I click it off? Here it is. So, look at that. Buchanan loves to write. He spends more time on his columns today than ever before. He says about 5 hours on each one. The rest of his time in recent years has been consumed by books. This fucking guy is an addict. He's a fucking literacy addict. And because he's got an outlet, he's a vomiting addict. He reads and then types it up. Let's see. So going down, how does it end? It's a long article. Geez, so much. Go to the very bottom and see what his last line is. Trump or no Trump, Buchanan has only become more alarmed about America's political trajectory. That means he's more alarmed about him fucking self and his mythic stage of literacy. That's what he's alarmed about. He says the Republican Party's running out of white folks, he says. And historically, immigrant groups have voted overwhelmingly Democratic. He says, if you bring in 100 million people and they vote 60% Democratic and 40% Republican, you're buried. What I'm saying is the America we knew and grew up with, it's gone. And it's not coming back. Demographically, culturally, socially, in every way, it's a different country. And I think it's come to resemble more of an empire than a nation and a people. Buchanan's friends say that deep down he wants to be wrong about these predictions, and he admits that sometimes his pessimism gets the better of him. He never believed Trump would win in November. On Election Day, in fact, he bumped into Virginia Congresswoman Barbara Comstock's mother at the polling station and suggested that her daughter would soon be running for higher office to replace Hillary Clinton's vice presidential nominee, Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. So he thought that Hillary would win and the politician's daughter would have a chance being vice president or something. Instead, he found himself up at 3 in the morning celebrating, basking in congratulatory emails and convincing himself that maybe, just maybe, America isn't doomed yet. Then the last line. But this, he says, is the last chance for these ideas. Well, no, the meme of literacy carries on. Now, Ayn is saying the literacy thing meme, most memes stay, keep going, but we're coming to a real crisis where the literacy meme is gone, completely kaput. So that would violate the retrieval of cliches and archetypes. Most archetypes don't disappear. So here he is, an idiot, celebrating the victory, but he didn't believe it. I mean, this is really good. This is a literate person, a ghost. This is a ghost of literacy reacting to Trumpism, trying to find what is literate in this, and they're not going to find it, and yet he thinks it's his ideas. So Buchanan is just the average American, totally deluded, totally has no clue what's going on. And, you know, would if they heard me saying this, we should fucking excerpt this and send it to them. My fucking review of his stupid life. And send it to him. He would be, he'd last about 2 minutes. I don't like this guy's tone. You know, this guy's a snob. Yeah. He'd have some ridiculous emotional reaction to me. He wouldn't have the fucking smarts. I'll have to put this at the fucking beginning. This guy ain't got the fucking smarts to listen to this recording. We're doing him a favor sending to him. But I'm just another noisemaker, you know, in the situation. But I'm the best noisemaker. My noise turns into gold. And I've got 5 people here to fucking back me up.
Bob, your noise is bombastic.
Yeah, Bob, you know, it's super, super bombastic.
Can I just say, because for me, when you started to coach Hals, and I was sort of thinking, oh, my God, I'm not going to be able to comprehend anything. But then I decided, no, I'm just going to listen. And through the few sessions you did, I, for the first time, understood the whole effect of the atomic bomb, which I've heard you spoke about before so many times, but I could never get that big trigger, because it's quite a big trigger what that did.
Yeah.
And just as I got that, about a week later was that mohab. And then you've already said the atomic bomb, now that's been done, it's been obsolete, so it wasn't another atomic bomb, but it was the next best thing. And it was just for me, so your timings, and then
impeccable.
The other memes, yes, very, very
I'm always a good timing. That's what McLuhan says. Back in the slower day, when you could find out who was an artist, he said the artist always has perfect pitch for his time. And McLuhan goes through the history of art and shows how each guy or woman had perfect pitch in their art. It might appear ugly, but it was actually resonant with the time. I know that my existence has perfect pitch with the time, and that's why fucking Ion showed up. You guys don't need a movie. You don't need an opera. You don't need a book. You don't need any. You need my fucking pithy statements and wrapping up and killing the conversation. I continuously kill the conversation by putting you into mute awe at the insight.
Yeah. And this is validation of that.
Yes, right there. So, yeah, so what are we putting off the difficult stuff? I'm going to start reading incomprehensible stuff here soon. Just a mime. It's Finnegan's Wake in English, which you can't reduce Finnegan's Wake, but it's close to that. What is else is there to say? And Jason left. Jason comes in, we made his buddy famous, his music, we liked his music, and he's gone. I don't like this short-term layabout. Yeah, I've put in 3 or 4 hours, you know. I don't care what the fuck your life is, you know. Look at Bert. Bert's probably on the bus, you know. He's probably walking. He's probably at work right now, and he's doing his work by being here. Right, Bert? What time would it be there? Yeah, it's 6:40. So he's just going to work or something. Okay, well, nothing you want to bring up of what we've done?
Let me just say, Switzerland.
Just a minute, Carol.
Hang on. Time in Switzerland is 6:41.
Yeah, that same time as us.
Uh-huh, so they're 12 hours.
No? Yeah. Okay. And Berlin is, and most of Europe is one time.
I think the UK is 11 hours, isn't it?
Yeah, they're different.
Yeah,
they're an hour. What would that be? An hour.
Yeah, we're 20 to 6 in the morning.
Yeah, we're 20 to 7. You're 20 to 6. You're an hour behind. So, what else happened? Nope. Looks like I'm going to have to look at some actual stuff here. Did I post the Buchanan article? I think I did.
You did,
yeah.
Bob.
Yeah. So it's a long article. There's a lot of factual, literate details in this article. They cover a lot of stuff because he covered a lot of things. So it's a major article on him and his history. Okay. tempted to find something easy and just fucking play a recording. That way, you know, I can...
Well, maybe some music, Bob.
No, music's stupid. That's what... It is. We're trying to get serious. I'm trying to offer interesting stuff that's relevant here. Maybe I'll play the last 4 minutes of this documentary on McLuhan. So you have, I don't know which daughter this is, Stephanie, and she's saying, I don't pretend to understand him all the time. So let's just hear how this ends. So it leaves the wedding scene.
Right, aphoristic matter. It's just an aside.
I do understand.
Interesting. McLuhan, he went on the album for the Mediumist Massage album, which is the book in audio. They ask him, what is the medium is the message? What is that statement? What are you doing? He says, it's an aside. Now, that's really important. This guy is studied as a philosopher, as a sociologist, all these bookology memes thrown at him. But all he was doing as an actor in the Global Theater was just making an aside. He says in his letter to Pound in 1951, I'm going to create a distraction on the sidelines. He knew that the unfolding Android meme was not going to be stopped by any individual or something. So he's saying it's an aside, and he's talking about his comment. He's saying male ejaculation is an aside compared to the long, drawn-out pregnancy. So look at the metaphor he's making of himself. If you know the other things, you know this complex poetry he's stating here, even though it just looks like a little simple interview.
It's outward for a great period. Now, fatherhood is a very abrupt, aphoristic matter. It's just an aside.
I do understand only when he does explain it to us, not as he writes it.
The only order that the young can create in a very fast-moving world of information overload, the only order they can create is that of myth. They don't think mythically. They still think in the old patterns, 19th-century patterns. But they live mythically. They live surrounded by mythic monsters like go-go girls.
Aren't they going to turn that down?
Well, waiting for go-go...
Medium is the message. Growing up absurd. The go-go girls ordinarily have a cage. While appearing to manifest their energies untrammeled, unconstrained, sound in this kind of world is not used as something to be listened to. It is kind of foam rubber which you press against and it presses back against you, makes you feel kind of wanted. Sound in the new world of dance song is not for listening, it's for making. And so the go-go girls,
he's saying song is not for listening, it's for making. No, who the fuck back there? What are you talking about? I'm listening to this music, and it's not for listening. But he's saying it's like foam rubber. It presses up against you. You press back on it, and it makes you feel wanted. See? Pretty interesting statements there, eh? Not for listening. As I
said. I like that image, Bob, of the go-go girl of being someone who's appearing to be unlimited and open, but they're in a cage.
Yeah, yeah. That's what, and then he says, Growing Up Absurd, which was a famous book by an anarchist thinker, Paul somebody, in the 60s. Influential book, Growing Up Absurd, talking about the kids of the 60s. So are you looking at the video, Michael?
No, but I do know the video. I saw it this week, Bob.
Oh, you just happened to already do it. So you're tuned into me.
I'm tuned into Bob.
Yeah. So he's making interesting statements. Back then, you had to, if you were interested in, okay, he's saying, well, no, how can this be? We're not listening. What's he talking about? Then you read him and you find out somewhere what he meant.
Locked up in each in her little world represents a kind
each in their own little world. He talks about this as Cape Canaveral caper, where the first moonshots were practiced, Cape Canaveral. Everybody's in their own little space. They're starting to create their own bubble. This is the analog media creating virtual reality or living mythically in your own mixed media space, which is then going to be replayed by the Android meme, where it has many little bubbles of itself, among itself, and you're thinking you're a part of those little bubbles. But it's already acted out here in the 60s.
The theater of the absurd, in which all communication has broken down. In fact, no attempt
to... He's now quoting the big art theater, you know, he calls it Waiting for Gogo, rather than Waiting for Godot. Now he's talking about the theater that was part of, Theater of the Absurd. It's just where all communication is broken down. It's a post-connecting, post-matching world, which is, you know, replayed violently within the Android meme for the Android meme and not the chemical body. So the Armageddon for the chemical body happens in the 60s.
It's really made to communicate. Each puts on his own show in his own little straitjacket.
He puts on his own little straitjacket. That's what he said. In her own little cell, I think he said.
In her little world, represents a kind of theater of the absurd in which all communication has broken down. In fact, no attempt is really made to communicate. Each puts on his own show in his own little straitjacket.
I have, by the way, a peculiar reading habit that I developed in recent years. I read only the right-hand page of serious books. If it's a frivolous, relaxing book, I read every word. But serious books, I read on the right-hand side only because I've discovered an enormous redundancy in any well-written book. And I find that by reading only the right-hand page, this keeps me very wide awake, filling in the other page out of my own noodle.
He's making up what he reads. Now, this was really shocking when people heard this back then. And he's just saying that right after saying the go-go dancers are making up their own world, making up their own communication within a straitjacket. So it's absurd. Yeah. They're communicating to nobody, but they want to communicate. And his explanations don't stop the girls' go-go dance. They're not thinking of that's why they're dancing. They just like dancing and the massage of it. And they're not interested in the explanation. They don't hear the explanation. And it shows how his explanations don't stop the world. Unfolding. Beg your pardon?
An aside.
Right, it's an aside. Whereas 150 years ago, if someone made a statement, the world would stop a little bit. And then maybe they'd become Prime Minister of England for doing it. But there was attempts, on a smaller scale, you could influence people with speech. And you'll see when we read critical semiotics, they're always talking about the inadequacy of language, or what's called semiology, the sign functioning is too much signifying. There's no signifying going on here. This is a-signifying in this show.
Entirely unexpected. I don't follow them always, but they're not entirely unexpected.
I'm going to go back a bit.
Very wide awake, filling in the other page out of my own noodle.
His ideas aren't entirely unexpected. I don't follow them always, but they're not entirely unexpected. It's a curious thing, but after he has an insight, it seems so logical. I wonder why I didn't think of it. I never would have. But one thing follows another so logically that the conclusion seems so logical to me at any rate, but I've been brainwashed.
If I were to trust the observations of my critics, I would despond and despair to the point of cutting my throat. However, I find a certain amount of pleasure in such activities as I engage in. And it is mainly in the process of making discoveries that I find my satisfactions. I find no satisfactions whatever in reading about them, or I can't bear to reread anything I have ever written, or I couldn't bear to rehear anything I've ever said. That is, I might have to bear it, but it wouldn't be fun.
the end. So, nobody back then, Malcolm Muggeridge, Kenneth Clark, Jacob Bernowski, Carl Sagan, none of these guys would say that about themselves. You know, if I actually took my critics seriously, I'd slit my throat. Now, I'm the closest to a guy who could say all that stuff. I'm the most denigrated, blasphemed person on the planet. And if I took anybody seriously, I would have killed Carol a long time ago. I go further. He didn't say that. McLuhan, I redo McLuhan more extremely. Right, Carol?
Yeah, Bob, you bring forth non-physical and then it beats you up.
It's non-physical, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking that coming home today from the beach. I was saying, you know, I've never been in a fight. I don't know how to fight. But I can say to any bully, you fuck with me, this fucking thing will get you. I am.
Yeah. Best bodyguard.
Yeah.
Bob, there's a
current bodyguard.
What?
There's an iron recording that so lines up with this whole thing where McLuhan shows that when he reads the book, he's not looking for the pattern. So he's not looking for agreement, which is in this one recording, Iron says, Iron's not looking for agreement.
Right.
And then you respond to Iron saying that by saying, you're looking for responses for the ratio of the moment. And that's
right.
Where he's, McLuhan says he's got the satisfactions in the process of making these discoveries.
Yeah.
It is so,
well, now you're really
so marvelous.
Now you're really, so you're listening to some of those, that really good Tony Schwartz recordings, studio recordings, McLuhan privately explaining things. Is that what you're listening to?
It's just little bits of what I pick up. There's another thing that I can't find any written stuff where McLuhan says it, but a recording where I heard McLuhan say, the future of work is plainly knowing, which
right.
also lines up with all of this.
That's in one of the Tony Schwartz things. Yeah, because I remember we never heard that before until I found that. Yeah, that's what people do. They just keep up. They just have to know, and they're not seeing everything, but they have a sense of knowing thing by looking at the headlines or their emails. That's their main job, is just knowing, being familiar.
Yeah, and that's not memory. That's not memory. And,
right.
And that's, for me, I see that access to all knowing,
access?
Which is the iron access.
Access.
Iron says you don't need to know everything. All you need is access to all knowing.
Right.
And
which
then
you have, digitally you have that. You just have to be told something, then you just go online and look at it.
Yeah. And then McLuhan defined that as that's the future of work. That's all work's going to be.
Yeah, processing information.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
The satire is, obviously people can't live like that. So he's trying to point out, this is what you're going to want and what you largely will be doing, but everything's going to collapse all around you. Because the society, until we're nodes like in the Matrix, nodes inside imaginary worlds, and are being fed somehow, that'll be a world of knowing. But in the meantime, you have this impulse to know, demand on you, the software world, while your chemical body can't keep up. And that's why medicine got kicked out of the room, and they've just brought in pharmaceutical dispensaries. Like, as Carolyn's, a lot of her career is just realizing how correct McLuhan was about the disappearing of medicine. Because nobody could keep up with the knowing demand. And so so people know in different media. Buchanan just reads 5 newspapers a day. He thinks that's what he has to do to know. I just have to talk to Ion and then fake secular knowing. Yeah, just look at the Drudge Report and see what headline is about me, you know, and then that's my knowing.
Hmm.
What were you going to say, Sean?
Yeah, and the knowing that it's not talking to you. In the
right.
in the recording you just played earlier on the first segment, McLuhan said this, I just wrote the phrase, I'm beautified the junkyard, throw something beautiful away.
Yeah, the junkyard says, listen to this, the junkyard has a sign, help beautified junkyards, throw something lovely away today. What?
Yeah,
no, I think it's
that
lovely.
Mass-
anyway,
yeah.
you throw something lovely. So he's saying, McLuhan's saying, he talks about the planet as a junkyard, an old space nose cone, because satellites create a new reality and the world's been junked. The planet has been extended and junked. And so everything's junk, so you throw something beautiful away. He's saying that his work is something beautiful, but it's just being tossed into a junkyard.
Oh, brilliant. I saw a whole
yeah.
different... Hold
and you see, Zappa has the same idea. Zappa has the same awareness. What'd you say, Michael or Nick?
No, I said I also had a completely different meaning, and you brought in something completely different there with what John's saying with the junkyard.
Yeah.
So your interpretation is very different to what I was thinking, Bob.
Well, what were you thinking?
No, that it was the meme that McLuhan was bringing in there was absolutely totally different to what you were talking about, the world becoming this junkyard, and we're living in this junkyard.
No,
so,
no, he said that. That's what he said. I'm quoting McLuhan in my meaning. This is not my interpretation. This is what McLuhan says, what he meant by saying that aphorism or that sign. In the world had become a junkyard, he called it an abandoned nose cone. The literal Earth Gaia planet, the terrestrial part, had become an abandoned nose cone, like something tossed off a rocket ship as it goes out to the moon. Some part gets disbanded. That's the world and all the media in it. Once you have satellites go around the planet, the satellite is the new nature, the new environment. So the whole world becomes a junkyard. By 1970, he was calling it a garbage apocalypse.